listeners, and welcome to the pilot episode of our literary podcast, Sevens Up, a program written and produced entirely by 7th grade students. We're your hosts, Carter,
Caleb,
and Kai, and today you'll be hearing a diverse batch of writing pieces written and read by 7th grade authors. First up, you'll be hearing some personal essay writing based on our recent ELA writing unit entitled I Believe. Afterwards, you'll hear some Q&As with the authors. This will be followed by public service announcement from our very own host, Carter.
Then you'll hear Maya Dynamark host I'm Right, You're Wrong, a debate section. This podcast, we're focusing on the positives and negatives of a controversial current event, trophy hunting. After that, Stella King will bring you some interesting views on sexism in her Person on the Street segment.
And finally, we'll wrap it up with Bench Frells on the Shelves, where you'll hear reviews on some of today's hottest young adult novels, and a segment in which Emmett Hendry and a 7th grade author will remind us that no matter how old we get, we are really still children at heart.
I Believe is a recent 7th grade writing unit where students wrote about meaningful memories which created and connected a strongly held belief about the world. Many students chose to write of important moments that profoundly affected their life. With a variety of emotions and diverse topics, these pieces invoke powerful feelings amongst readers. Here's Walt Phillips introducing author Jesse Pomeroy.
Hi, my name is Walt Phillips. You will be hearing a piece written and spoken by Jesse Pomeroy. His piece is titled, I Believe That You Can't Build a Wall Between You and Your Parents. It talks about him blocking himself off, then opening up to his dad.
I believe that you can't build a wall between you and your parents. When you were growing up, especially when you were about 11 to 18, depending on many factors, you start to have complex emotions and opinions about life and other things. Sometimes you do what I did. I shut off from my parents. I've had a few difficult instances in my life. During those times, I have had a lot of emotions that I wanted to express. Instead of expressing them, I put up a wall and did not talk at all to anyone, especially my parents. I kept these feelings inside me and I cut myself off from them. I watched as my relationship with them increased in silence. I had so many emotions that I used them as bricks to build a wall in my house. I cut myself off from the people who were raising me, the best resource I would ever have to manifest those emotions. The keys jingled in the door as my dad walked into the house. I was sitting at the table, hunched over some homework. My dad heaved a big sigh. He walked into the dining room and put his hand on my shoulder. Hey, Jesse, how was your day? Anything you want to talk about? Yes, definitely, I thought, but all I said was I'm fine. I got up and slowly walked down the hallway to my room. My head hung down. Did I say what I should have? What should I do? I dragged my hand across the wall. Beads of sweat dripped down my face. I slowly walked into my room and closed the door behind me. I shut the door on my feelings of doubt, my feelings that I didn't just do the best I could have for myself. My dad had tried to reach me, to talk to me, but I pushed him away. I didn't even show I was slightly down. I just reacted in the blandest way I possibly could. I barely knew at the time why I did that. Maybe I was oblivious to the fact that another person could help me with my feelings, or just too proud to let him help me. That evening, my dad came to me again to bid me goodnight. He asked the same question. Do you want to talk about anything? In my mind, I was fighting on what to do, to talk to him or to keep shutting myself off. He was really trying to reach me. Finally, I was so tired, I completely cracked. The wall slowly but surely came down. I had an hour-long discussion with him about what I had been feeling the whole day. When I fell asleep later that night, as I closed my eyes, I knew that I felt much better. As a kid who has been given so many opportunities to talk to someone about my feelings, whether that be a therapist or my aunt, I've realized the importance of your parents. They will help you through hard times and will stick with you no matter what. That is how I learned not to build a wall between you and your parents.
Wow, that story was so amazing. Can you tell me what made you come up with this belief?
Well, essentially, I had this moment in my life. It was not just one, obviously, but this one stuck out the most. It really had a strong impact on me as a person, and it helped me through some hard times, so I did want to write about it to share it with the world. And what a better way than an essay about the things that we truly believe in.
Is it easier to open up to your parents now?
Now, it is easier, although some things I still keep to myself, as a normal human would. But it really helps thinking about my essay in that moment. Since then, many things have happened, but I kept sharing what I could, and it gradually became less difficult and more routine.
Hello, this is Oscar Phillips. Today you will be hearing a piece written by Taylor Smith and spoken by Sari Kleinberg about how the standardized test system is flawed. Afterwards, I will ask Sari a few questions and she'll read answers supplied beforehand by the author Taylor.
I believe that there should be more to school than preparing you for a number. Ever since I was in third grade, almost everything that we learned in ELA and math prepared us for the state tests. I think that this is terrible. The state tests are like any other tests you get in school, but the Board of Education makes it a really big deal. In a normal test, you get the paper, you are given a certain amount of time to do it, and you either finish it or don't. The state tests are the same, but they don't teach you anything, they waste your time, and they make you feel like an idiot if you don't do well. Well, all you get in return is a number that affects you for the rest of your life. I find this horrible, because throughout most of my school life, I've been forced to take these tests. And every single year I've taken them, I've been worried I'll fail, leading me to not do well in school in the future. I've been fine every year, but because the Board of Education makes the tests such a big deal, all we do in ELA and math is prepare for them, which makes me, and probably other kids, very nervous and stressed out for most of the year. Last year, I opted out of the tests, and it felt great. Sixth grade was probably the best year I'd had after third grade because I didn't need to worry about the tests. Unfortunately, this year I can't opt out because in seventh grade, the score I get in the tests will affect me and what high school I get into, which will affect most of my life. I believe that the state tests are dumb and shouldn't exist. Sadly, they do, and they are the main focus in school, which, as a student, I can tell you sucks. I think that if the state tests have to exist, they shouldn't be so important, and they should not stop school from being fun.
Thank you, Sari. If there are no state tests, what should high schools use for admissions?
If there were no state tests, I think that school could go on the same. High schools and middle schools would just look at the report card grades instead. Personally, I don't think there's a point in having report cards if there are still state tests.
And finally, what was your worst experience taking the state tests?
My least favorite experience taking the test would probably have been in third grade. This is because it was my first year, so I was 10 times more stressed than any other year.
Hi everyone, this is Audrey Park, and with me today is Ishmam Fardin, who will be reading his personal essay about his immigration story and how he has changed since moving to America from Bangladesh.
I believe we should spend our time wisely. Most of us spend our time on electronic devices. Ever since technology was invented, people spent less time with their family and friends. Since my family is immigrants, my dad has to work a little harder than most people because he is not from here, which leads to less time with family time. Have you ever heard the phrase, time is money? Well, it sort of is. When I was in Bangladesh, our family was mostly outdoors, going to zoos, festivals, and on cruises. My dad was a teacher and also a tutor. He came home around 3 p.m. That's when we when we would go outside to have fun and enjoy. It was almost the same thing every day, but one day something happened that changed my whole life. My dad got his visa, which meant we would have to go to America. When we started to go on the bus, I noticed none of my relatives were coming. I started to go for the door, but I was too late. The bus started moving and I started to cry as I watched them pass by from the window. When we got to America, I saw many things I had never seen before. After a while, my dad got a job, and now he works at least 10 hours a day. My whole family changed, including me. I got bored and had nothing to do. So then I started playing computer and video games, which I got addicted to. And now with my grandma and grandpa, who came from Bangladesh, I spend less time with them. It's as if I'm being possessed by the games I play. I try talking and playing with them, but I'm just not the same guy who used to talk a lot. I have nothing to talk about at all. They can't play because all I have is soccer ball, and my grandparents aren't really the people who play soccer since they're old. Before in Bangladesh, I used to be active. I talked a lot. I was even an outside person. But now, I guess you can say I'm boring. All I'm anxious about is that if my grandparents pass away, I'll feel guilty they had to see me so different. Life can change, and so can we. And we might not even have time for anything, but we shouldn't change who we are. And if we already changed, we have to try to be ourselves again. Trust me from my experience. Sometimes I would like to go outside to play soccer, but I end up playing video games. I believe we shouldn't change ourselves into something different no matter what lays ahead of us.
So what made you choose to write about this and link it back to your life?
Well, many people can relate to my situation, and it isn't just games. It is also social media. Many people, like, if their family or grandparents come over, they won't really pay attention to them. They will be on their computer or playing Xbox or something they like to do.
What makes it so hard for you to spend time with your grandparents?
Well, my grandparents can't really speak English, and I'm sort of forgetting my Bengali language because I stayed in America longer than in Bangladesh. If I told them about Donald Trump, they'd be like, what? And I try to speak to them sometimes, but I have nothing else to say. If I was talking to an average student, I would have a lot of things to say.
Hello, listeners. Carter here with a very important public service announcement. We need to discuss a very important word and its usage. Literally. In our world, where social media is the dominant way of communication and time is scarce, we like to abbreviate things. OMG and LOL, for example, are three-letter words, onomatopoeias, whatever. Even so, no matter how rushed we are, it seems that everyone has time to fully write out, and even in most cases, incorrectly use one infamous word, literally. The definition of literally goes along the lines of the whole actual unexaggerated truth. Every single factor of what you're about to say is 100% correct. It's not figurative, and as a matter of fact, believe it or not, it's a literal word. With this in mind, we'd all have better grammar, since we've all incorrectly used literally once or twice, officially bringing the average human being's literacy past that of a turkey drowning in a mud puddle. So how can we avoid using literally incorrectly? Let's check out a couple of examples to find out. The wrong way. Oh my god, it's so hot out that my phone is literally melting in my pocket. Analysis. Let me tell you something. If your phone was actually melting in your pocket, you wouldn't be complaining about the atmosphere being hot. You'd be complaining about the molten metal and plastic slowly running down your pant leg. And no, this will never happen unless you live on Venus. And no, your parents won't buy you an iPhone 6 just because your previous phone melted. The right way. When I was on the cyclone, I literally almost threw up. Analysis. Okay, that sounds reasonable. You get a little queasy on roller coasters and you rode the cyclone. Almost throwing up is important to you, so you emphasize and confirm the truth. You nearly put today's breakfast on tomorrow's sneakers. There may be a little bit of exaggeration, but it still sounds reasonable to your unknowing listener, so it's fine. To To sum it all up, we need to get our stuff together when it comes to, speaking English, especially with powerful words such as literally, which can be used to tell truth from lie, exaggeration from actuality, and many more things. It's not a word to be molded, abused, or overused, so understanding how to use it is critical. Literally critical.
This is Caleb Griffin again, introducing Maya Dynamark.
Hi, I'm Maya Dynamark, the host of I'm Right, You're Wrong, the debate portion of this podcast. Today you're going to hear two sides of a debate about trophy hunting, the sport of legally hunting and killing African wildlife such as lions and elephants. This debate was inspired and informed by the recent Upfront magazine article, Animals vs. Humans, written by Alessandra Potenza. First, you'll hear from Gus Toth and Jesse Cantor, who strongly oppose trophy hunting on ethical grounds.
Trophy hunting should be eliminated as a sport. Too many people are killing endangered African animals for fun, and the only benefit seems to be bragging rights. Recently, Walter Palmer, a dentist from Minnesota, shot and killed an endangered lion named Cecil. Palmer claimed that he did not know he had killed an endangered and protected animal, but he himself actually lured Cecil out of a protected zone in order to kill him. Obviously, trophy hunters know they are breaking rules, but that doesn't stop them. It seems like they think it's cool to see animals die.
The point is, African animals are dying because of the poachers and trophy hunters' own greedy needs. They don't care whether the animal is nearly extinct or if there is a surplus of the animal. They just want to put the animal's head on the wall to prove that they killed it. It's for no other reason. This has to end soon. To quote the Upfront article, it is a cruel and tasteless sport.
Next up, we have Milo Kessler and Miles Lindquist, who believe this practice may have some benefits, socially and economically.
It's easy to say, oh, trophy hunting is evil. But if you think outside the box, you would see that there is more than just killing innocent African animals. These animals, specifically lions and rhinos, may even have started the fight.
It's not fair to say that trophy hunting is only a negative thing. Sure, it isn't pleasant to hear about animals being killed, but trophy hunting has many benefits.
First of all, in Zimbabwe, lions have been known to kill both humans and valuable livestock. In Africa, lions are considered objects of terror, according to the article. The bottom line is that if these animals are really completely innocent, humans wouldn't be killing them.
Also, in Africa, trophy hunting helps the economy. Hunters have to pay for permits and go on hunting safaris. You can easily say that no one should kill animals, even for money, but this happens to be a $200 million a year business. It helps African people and makes money for their countries. Trophy hunting contributes to society by providing money for schools, medical clinics, and other important infrastructures. That doesn't sound that bad, does it?
So in the end, trophy hunting isn't even that bad.
It definitely has benefits.
Thank you. Now a question for each side. How do you think trophy hunting will affect society in later years?
Lions are at the top of the food chain. So if they go extinct, then as you can imagine, it gives all wildlife a domino effect. And then maybe not for a while, but animals will cease to exist.
The animals below it on the food chain will grow drastically in number and will eat all the animals below it in the food chain. They will both end up going extinct, and then the animals below that will grow drastically in numbers and will cause infestation.
In a few years, if the industry is continued, then the $200 million a year business will greatly help nearby communities.
Thank you, debaters. This is Maya Dynamark signing off.
Welcome to Person on the Street. I'm Stella King, your host for today. On today's show, you're going to hear from three different women, two of which are students in the seventh grade. Pearl Tolliver Shaw, Isabella Kelly, and Miss Berner, the principal of MS 51. My original I Believe essay was about how sexism is still a part of the world today. I'm really interested in this topic because I think it's completely unfair, and I wanted to hear the opinions of other women. Introducing Pearl Tolliver Shaw. Why do you think sexism still exists today?
I think sexism still exists and has evolved over time because in America today we have many new opportunities that we haven't had in the past, and this gives men more of an opportunity to be sexist towards women because, I mean, there's all these new things, like, say, playing sports. Women are able to play more sports today. This is an opportunity for men to, you know, say to women that they're not able to do it. And so I think it's evolved over time because there are many new opportunities and men are taking this the wrong way in situations.
Next, we have Isabella Kelly. How does it make you feel when you experience and see sexism in your life?
Overall, I think that it's unfair and almost disgusting that it's still going on. And when I see it, it almost makes me sad because I'm seeing these people having unfair expectations and they're just being compared to things that maybe they shouldn't be. And I do think it's sad, but at the same time, it's almost what I expect because it's been going on for so long, and hopefully that it won't be going on for longer. But for now, we just kind of have to live with these stereotypes. One time when I experienced sexism with a friend was that we were just walking down the street, nothing really exciting happening, but then a man on the side of the street catcalled at my friend. And yes, maybe it happens all the time, but sometimes we get to see these small moments where women are just being seen as only objects and not as a real person with a face, a personality, because they're just more than, I don't know, maybe their legs or what they were being seen as. And I just hope that one day we don't have to be walking down the street scared that we're being judged of by what we're wearing and that maybe somebody's gonna judge us and compare it to a different gender, because we should just be able to be comfortable with ourselves and not have to deal with these stereotypes in the world that are still here.
Ms. Berner, what do you suggest young girls do to deal with sexism in their life?
Well, sexism has always been a part of our world. It's always been a part of my world, but it never stopped me from doing what I wanted to do. So I guess I would say to girls to just be focused on their goals and do what they want to do in their life. There's really nothing that can stop you. Certainly, I don't think we're lucky enough in America. I think that you can do whatever you want to do through studying, getting a great education, and pursuing a career that really interests you. I feel like that's what I did. Although in my position as a leader and being the boss of men and women, over the years, I have felt sort of sometimes a strange reaction from the men, but again, staying focused and just being the best that you can be in your job, you know, success will speak for itself.
All right, that's all for today. See you next time on Person on the Street.
Hi, this is Ben Chaffrell with On the Shelves. Today with me are Max English and Nicholas Wilson. They will be reviewing two different books. Max will be telling us about Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Old School, which is the 10th book in the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series. It is about a boy whose life spirals out of control time and time again. Nicholas will tell us about Magnus Chase, a boy in a fantasy world who just wants to be reunited with his mother.
Sometimes, just after finishing a really hard book, I like to take a walk down memory lane. I like to read those easy-to-read books that are just meant to give you a laugh. Of course, I'm talking about the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series by Jeff Kinney. As many of you know, his new story, Old School, just came out. It's another story just like the last, but somehow Kinney keeps the readers entertained. I think it has something to do with the characters. As normal, life seems to be against the main character, Greg. He does small things that affect him deeply. Begins with a small problem, his mother leading a no-technology weekend. Greg sees his opportunity and his life begins to spiral out of control once again. He doesn't change, so it begins to get boring. I can honestly tell you, however, that the first couple times I read these, they were my favorites. As I was saying before, the characters never change. They go on great journeys, but don't change. When I was littler, I didn't mind it or didn't care about it. In fact, I thought the jokes were so funny, I just laughed through the entire book, not realizing that the characters were completely the same. Now that I'm more of an active reader, it doesn't satisfy me. The structure, however, is pretty cool. It's neat how Diary of a Wimpy Kid is literally a diary. I decided to give this book, along with all of them, 3 stars. I'd given earlier books higher ratings, but now, after reading this, I changed. The structure raises the level a bit, but not enough to keep this reader entertained.
The book Magnus Chase by Rick Riordan is a great book that kept me wanting to read more. In my opinion, it was great because of all the things the author included. You should definitely pick it up and give it a try. At the beginning of the book, you are in the mind of Magnus Chase, a 6-year-old homeless boy who gets woken up by his friend Blitz, who is another homeless person, and is told that people are looking for him. Now if you think, oh, people are probably just looking for him to help him or something like that, well, he's getting chased by his uncle so that he doesn't get killed. Yeah, even with his uncle's efforts, he dies. This isn't a spoiler. The first chapter is called Good Morning, You're Going to Die, so it's not like you weren't going to figure it out. Even though he dies, the book is anything but over. The book continues to spiral on and on in an intense way and is amazingly good and full of intensity and suspense. Magnus is a hothead who goes into things very stupidly. Magnus eventually realizes that he actually has to think before doing things. This gives the book a funny feel to it along with the action and suspense. In my opinion, the book was written very well, even with an airhead of a main character. The author plays the story out very well, which kept me reading and wanting to read more when I finally put it down. Now I am waiting for the next book to come out, which seems like forever. I gave this book a 5-star rating because of how amazing and great this book was. I liked the book a lot because of how funny the main character was sometimes and how there were so many different things happening on their quest, which made it a lot better. This book is great, but it would have been better if the main character didn't just do things without thinking.
Thank you, Nicholas, and thanks for everybody listening. These books will probably be available at your school or local library or at a bookstore near you. This is Bench Fellow with On the Shelf. It's been great, it's been fun, but my time here is done.
Hi, I'm Emmett Hendry. Today I'll be introducing a writing piece by Sam Levine called Imagining Elephants. The story is about how 2 stuffed animal elephants changed a 3-year-old's life up to this day, and how, as little kids, we believe anything and everything. Luckily, we have Sam Levine with us today to read his work.
If you really knew me, you would know I have 2 stuffed elephants, called Ellie Old and Ellie New. Their story begins when I was the age of about 3. The first Ellie, Ellie Old, came attached to the top of a larger present, which may have been a piece of clothing or a toy. And when my little eyes made contact with his plush exterior, he never left my grasp. I dragged him around the house, in the park, on the train, and could never fall asleep unless I had him by my side. My mother feared I would lose him, so she brought 3 extras and concealed them in her closet. Then, one morning, Ellie went missing. Minna, my babysitter at the time, quickly pulled one out from the sack the extras were hidden in. Then she washed it and gave me my Ellie back. But of course, days later, I reached into the crack between my bed and the wall and pulled out the real Ellie. 2 Ellies, I screamed, running into my parents' bedroom. In a moment of panic, my mother and father explained that this was Ellie's cousin from California and used a lint roller to telephone his parents. They said he could stay for 3 days. At the end of these 3 days, I reluctantly gave Ellie's cousin back to my mother. But then, months later, I noticed 2 blue legs sticking out of a closet shelf. Mommy, Ellie's cousin is back, I yelled, finding my mother, who was reading a book in the living room. She quickly improvised a story that Ellie flew in through the conveniently open window, and instead of making a right into my room, made a left into the hallway closet. We called his parents, but at the end of his stay, I wouldn't let him go, so he stayed. And years later, the story was revealed to me. And that is how Ellie Auld and Ellie New came into my life.
Thank you, Sam. I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions. How do the Ellies affect you up to this day?
The Ellies are a very vivid memory of my childhood. They also symbolize the fact that I hate change, which is why it's really hard for me to throw out the garbage. I feel more attached to Ellie Auld, who I've had longer. You can kind of tell by all the rips in him. He also had the smell that kind of helped me to sleep, so the other Ellie became just an extra, until the day I almost lost him. But that's another story.
Well, we've come to the end of our pilot episode of our podcast, Sevens Up. We hope you enjoyed it.
Thanks to today's authors and speakers, Jesse, Walt, Taylor, Sari, Oscar, Ishmam, Audrey, Maya, Gus, Jesse, Milo, Miles, Stella, Pearl, Isabella, Miss Burner, Ben, Max, Nicholas, Emmett, and Sam.
Sevens Up was produced by Ryan Michelle Woods with associate producer Isabel Count, who also wrote some original music for this recording. Thanks to Jeff Sprawl for providing graphics and Diana Velez Griffin for all her advice and assistance. Fundings of 7UP was provided by Tim Mather, Ronnie Rothstein, Lisa Schuckman, and Scott Schaffrell, Caroline O'Hare, the Braun family, and Sigrid Jacob.
Additional funding provided by Leslie Sprawl, Marcia Landis, Simi Dynamark, In Cho, Rachel Masters, Jennifer Cantor, Proshat Linguist, Tracy Wilson, the Fishberg Kessler family, Thomas Piper Gissendanner, David Van Taylor, Samantha Brown, Sabrina Farhi, Victoria Toeth, Sarah Williams, Maxine Park, Laura Melville, and Joe Phillips, with matching funds donated by our friends at Donors Choose.
Finally, the executive producer of Sevens Up would like to dedicate the pilot episode of this podcast to the late, great author Lee B. Woods, a pioneer in understanding the power of children's writing. His popular grammar storybook, Finding King on Mauna Pea, is available on Amazon.com.